So we turn then to this chapter 15, first of all, this evening. And so far, we have seen that all the three friends, or supposed friends, of afflicted Job have worked more or less on the same principle. They have insisted that his great suffering is due not merely to the fact that he is a sinner, but to the fact that he is a great sinner, that he is not a true believer, that he's not truly godly, but that he is in fact a hypocrite. Their argument is great sin. Therefore, although Job may have seemed to be godly, it mustn't have really been the case, and he is a hypocrite. That is basically the argument, more or less, of all of Job's three friends. So they've accused him of being a sham, whereas he maintains his integrity. He's not insisting that he's without sin. He's simply saying that he's not a hypocrite, that he is a true believer, and that he was seeking to walk in the ways of the Lord as a believer. But now we enter the second round of this discussion, debate, and Eliphaz has another go. And we can say that he does three things. He insults Job, he accuses Job, and he warns Job. First of all, then, Eliphaz's insults in the first three verses. We should be quite clear that Eliphaz is hurt. Eliphaz is hurt. His pride is hurt that Job rejects his supposed wisdom. And we need to be clear that if we're going to be people who counsel others, then especially those who are in great distress, then we should be ready to be lashed out at. Eliphaz, even if his advice has been good, should have been ready to receive perhaps a strong response from a man in the condition and affliction and distress that Job was in. But Eliphaz is too concerned to prove himself right, to be of any use to poor afflicted Job. Eliphaz is concerned to win the argument. Eliphaz is concerned with his standing as a wise man. And so he, in verse 2, says, "Should a wise man utter vain knowledge and fill his belly with the east wind?" He's saying Job isn't as wise as he seemed. He has only vain knowledge or windy knowledge. And he's saying it as if Job had filled his belly with the east wind, and what came out from Job was just so much hot air of no profit at all. So that is what Job is saying about, that's what Eliphaz is saying about all that Job has said. All his words, all his pleadings, all his expressions of bewilderment, and his protest that was not sinless, he was a genuine believer who feared the Lord. Eliphaz tells him it's just hot air. And so verse 3, "Should he reason with unprofitable talk or with speeches wherewith he can do no good?" So Eliphaz insults the afflicted Job because his pride is hurt. Then we have Eliphaz accusing in verse 4 to verse 16. And there would seem to be four accusations that he levels against Job. First of all, ungodliness or irreverence of speech. Verse 4, "Yea, thou castest off fear and restrainest prayer before God. He means that his demand, Job insisting that he wanted a day in court with God, was irreverent, and he restrained prayer. Or the idea is that Job, by what he was saying, was undermining prayer. He was bringing a bad name upon religion by insisting that God does not punish the wicked immediately and doesn't necessarily punish the wicked at all in this life. And then in verses 5 and 6, we read, "For thy mouth uttereth thine iniquity, and thou choosest the tongue of the crafty. Thine own mouth condemneth thee, and not I. Yea, thine own lips testify against thee." He's saying his own words show him to be wicked. He chooses crafty expressions to conceal his real ungodliness, but to no effect. He hasn't fooled Eliphaz. That's what Eliphaz is saying to him. That your own words show you to be an ungodly man. You might try to dress up your ungodliness by clever expressions, but I can see through you. And so Eliphaz is saying that Job is an enemy of real godliness. That's the first accusation. Then the second accusation is that of pride, verses 7 to 9. He's saying, "Are you so ancient as to know all?" He's saying, verse 7, "Art thou the first man that was born, or wast thou made before the hills? What makes you think you know?" And then in verse 8, "Has God revealed himself specially and only to you? Hast thou heard the secret of God? And dost thou restrain," or perhaps the word can mean borrow, "wisdom to thyself?" Mind, Eliphaz had claimed special revelation from God in his first speech, but never mind. He's saying, "Are you the only one? Has God spoken specially to you?" And then in verse 9, he's just saying, "What's so special about you? What knowest thou that we know not? What understandest thou which is not in us?" Eliphaz is really annoyed that Job won't be told, that Job is holding out. He won't be told. Not only is he a hypocrite, but he won't be told that he's a hypocrite. That's the thinking in Eliphaz. And he won't recognize, and this is what is galling Eliphaz, he won't recognize the wisdom of his friend. Then accusation 3, the third accusation, is the accusation of foolishness. Verse 10 to verse 13. Why does Job think he's wise? Verse 10, "With us are both the grey-headed and very aged men, much elder than thy father." They're claiming that the wisdom of the ages is with Eliphaz and with his colleagues. Not that they are necessarily so much older than Job, but they're saying that they represent the views of the ancients. The accumulated wisdom of the generations. Then in verse 11, "Are the consolations of God small with thee? Is there any secret thing with thee?" He's saying that Job is devaluing their divine wisdom. He's saying, "Are the consolations, the things that God has revealed, and which we're trying to tell you, are these things of little value, small in your eyes?" The supposed revelation of Eliphaz and their wisdom that should bring consolation from God, Job, he's saying, is placing little value upon. Has he some secret revelation that is superior to theirs? Is there any secret thing with thee? And then verse 12 and 13, Why doth thine heart carry thee away, and what do thine eyes wink at, that thou turnest thy spirit against God, and lettest such words go out of thy mouth? Why do you in pride go your own way and wink, he means in mockery, at what we say? He's accusing Job of winking in sarcastic mockery of their wisdom, and speaking therefore foolishly against God. And then the fourth accusation is that Job is denying his own depravity. Verse 14, what is man that he should be clean, and he which is born of a woman that he should be righteous? Behold, he putteth no trust in his saints, yea, the heavens are not clean in his sight. How much more abominable and filthy is man which drinketh iniquity like water? Eliphaz is repeating in different words a great deal of what he said back in chapter 4 when he claimed a night revelation from God. He's saying that man is sinful. Even the angels, God doesn't trust them to be holy independently of him. They're only holy because he keeps them holy. So why do you think you're so pure? But notice that he uses certain phrases that Job has used. Man that is born of a woman. It's as if he's throwing Job's words back at him. Eliphaz is misrepresenting Job. He's saying that Job is pretending to be sinless and pure. And Job wasn't saying that. And in any case, Eliphaz and his colleagues haven't just said that Job is a sinner. They've said he's a hypocrite, an unconverted, unrepentant, proud rebel against God. So they are saying that he must be a wicked hypocrite. He's saying this is not so. But in order to put Job in the wrong, Eliphaz is accusing Job of pretending to be perfectly pure, which he did not claim. Eliphaz is distorting the picture. He's distorting and diverting attention from the obvious fact that Job has already pointed out, that those who are most wicked do not suffer most in this world. Now, Job has pointed that out. It's obviously the case. Eliphaz hasn't a real answer, and so he's blustering and accusing Job of things that Job has never said. But then, thirdly, Eliphaz warns in verse 17 to verse 35. Eliphaz warns of God's judgment. You see, Eliphaz really hasn't much left to say. And so, his pride is hurt. He has nothing very new to say. And so he repeats what he's already said with greater forcefulness. And of course, that's what people do, don't they? When they're stuck and they're annoyed and they're angry and their pride is wounded, they've got nothing more to say, so they just repeat and repeat what they've already said. And they do it with greater expressions of indignation and bluster and so on. And so he's telling Job to watch out in verse 17. He says, hear me, I'll tell you, I declare. Verse 18, he's saying that his words are the received wisdom which wise men have told from their fathers and have not hidden. In verse 19, he says his wisdom comes from men who inhabited the earth or the land. Same word in the Hebrew language, who inhabited the earth or the land alone. Now, he could be referring to those who lived just after the flood, or else he's referring to his forefathers who inhabited that part of the land when there was no mixture of peoples. At any rate, he's claiming great antiquity for his wisdom. Now, verse 20 onwards, the gist is that the judgment of the wicked may be delayed a short time in its outward form, but it is secretly at work in the terrors of the wicked, and always comes to open expression before very long, and definitely in this life. That's what Eliphaz is saying. You remember that Job has said, look, judgment does not fall on the wicked immediately. Anyone can see that. And sometimes it doesn't seem to fall at all in this present world. So Eliphaz is offering this desperate defense of his position. He's saying, well, there may be a bit of delay, but even so, it comes quickly, and in any case, the judgment has already started inwardly. So what Eliphaz is saying is, it may seem that wicked men are getting off all right for a while, but behind the facade, they're terrified inwardly. So verse 20, the wicked man travaileth with pain all his days, and the number of years is hidden to the oppressor. That is, it's appointed by God to the oppressor, that in due time the oppressor falls upon the wicked. And the implication is that the Sabaeans and the Chaldeans had fallen upon the house of Job because he was wicked. Verse 21, a dreadful sound is in his ears. It's the idea that the wicked man who seems to be prospering isn't really, because he's terrified inwardly. In prosperity, the destroyer shall come upon him. So he's saying justice isn't really delayed, though it sometimes starts inwardly before it shows itself outwardly, but it comes pretty quick anyway, and in this life. He believeth not that he shall return out of darkness, and he is waited for of the sword. Verse 22, he's saying, when the judgment comes, there's no hope when the darkness comes, and he waits for the sword of judgment. Verse 23, the wicked comes to poverty. Verse 24, trouble and anguish come upon him like a king with a conquering army. Trouble and anguish prevail over him. Verse 25, the reason, because of his contest with God, and the ungodly man in verse 26 is so foolish that he runs upon God, even on his neck, or with an outstretched neck, upon the thick bosses of his buckler. The idea is that the wicked man is like someone running towards a giant with a shield with bosses on it, and he just runs straight into them and is destroyed as he runs toward the bosses of the shield of the mighty. And so verse 27 reflects upon his former sinful indulgences and ease when he was fat, the idea of prosperity. Verse 28 and 29 describe the poverty that Eliphaz says must come, and comes quickly upon the wicked. And then verse 30, once begun, God will not let him recover. The flame shall dry up his branches, and by the breath of his mouth shall he go away. That is, the breath of God's mouth, God's word, sweeps him away. Then verse 31, let not him that is deceived trust in vanity, for vanity shall be his recompense. He's saying the wicked man is deceived by his trust in vanity, but let him not be so deceived as to the outcome. It will be vanity, emptiness. And then verse 32 to 35 illustrates the fact that it will come quickly. Before they have reached ripeness in their wickedness, it shall be accomplished before his time, and his branch shall not be green. He shall shake off his unripe grape as the vine, and shall cast off his flower as the olive, for the congregations of the hypocrites shall be desolate, and fire shall consume the tabernacles of bribery. They conceive mischief and bring forth vanity, and their belly prepareth deceit. So Eliphaz is maintaining his position. Judgment comes upon the wicked in this world. It comes quickly, and if there is any delay, it's only because the beginnings of judgment are hidden from our eyes, and the wicked are full of terrors inwardly, and the rest will follow very quickly. But then Job's reply, very briefly, just looking at the overall picture. In verse 16, Job tells his friends that they are miserable comforters. In verse 2, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are ye all. Things are getting pretty strained between Job and his friends. Job is in great distress, and these men come out with sometimes things that are true, sometimes things that are not true, but certainly nothing that's new and nothing that is of any great help to Job. And he is weary of their empty words in verse 3. And then he says, if the roles were reversed, I could do the same to you. In verse 4, I also could speak as ye do. If your soul were in my soul's stead, I could heap up words against you and shake my head at you. But then in verse 5 he says, I wouldn't do that, but I would strengthen you with my mouth, and the moving of my lips should assuage your grief. And they're telling him to be quiet, and in verse 6 he's saying, why? If I speak, my grief is not assuaged, though I forbear. What am I eased? It doesn't make any difference to my condition. So he's telling them they're miserable comforters. But then he's saying in verse 7 onwards that God has made him look like a wicked man under judgment, but the reason is not because he's a wicked man. He acknowledges that his appearance in the eyes of men is the appearance of a wicked man who has reaped his just deserts. But he's saying at the same time, whatever may look to be the case, that's not the explanation. You see, the friends have attacked him in two stages. They're saying that Job looks like a wicked man under judgment, and secondly, the reason is because he's a wicked man. Job acknowledges the first. Yes, he looks like a wicked man being judged for his sins, but he's not. And so he indicates something of his predicament. Again, in verse 7, he shows that he's isolated from former company. Families, servants have gone. Those who would have testified to his genuine godliness, they've all gone. They've been swept away. In verse 8 of chapter 16, he's saying that he looks old before his time. He's covered in wrinkles. And he looks like an old man, prematurely. In verses 9 to 11 of chapter 16, he's saying his enemies triumph over him. Those who had secretly hated him when he was prosperous now have a field day. They can do as they like. They didn't dare before, but now they can. And then in verse 12, he says, I was at ease, but God, in verse 11, he's saying that God has delivered me to the ungodly and turned me over into the hands of the wicked. I was at ease, but he had broken me asunder. He hath also taken me by my neck and shaken me to pieces. He's saying he's like a wild beast that takes his prey by the neck in his teeth and shakes him about. And then he's saying at the end of verse 12 and in verse 13, he's like a mark for the target practice of the archers. And in verse 14, he's like a stormed fortress, or one being attacked by a giant. But then in verse 15 to 17, he's saying the reason is not
because I'm a hypocrite. I may look like a wicked man who's got his just deserts, a hypocrite, but I'm not. He's saying he's not the proud man that they are representing him as. Verse 15, I have sewed sackcloth upon my skin and defiled my horn in the dust. His sackcloth was a sign of humbling, and the horn is the picture of all that was eminent. Everything that was eminent about Job, he'd laid in the dust before God. My face is foul with weeping. He's saying dust and tears are in his face because of his humbling before God. On my eyelids is the shadow of death. And so in verse 17, not for any injustice in mine hands, also my prayer is pure. He's saying, I'm not a hypocrite. I am a true believer. I may look like a man under the wrath of God, but I'm a believer. That's not the explanation. And then in verse 18, he issues a plea that his just cause will not be covered over after his death, that one day the truth of the matter will be brought out. And then verse 19, we have a glimpse of the advocate with the Father. Verse 19, also now behold, my witness is in heaven, and my record, or my recorder, or my advocate, the one who speaks for me, is on high. Compared with the friends, verse 20, my friends scorn me, but mine eye poureth out tears unto God. And then verse 21, oh, that one might plead for a man with God, as a man pleadeth for his neighbor. He desires this advocate. He gets glimpses of Christ, and his faith rises up like a wave of the sea before it sinks down again. That's what we're seeing in this book of Job, that his faith rises up and then he sinks again under distress. But the waves get higher as the book goes on. And so there are these glimpses of the desired advocate, the daysman, the one who sympathetically will speak for him. But then he sinks again in the last verse and the next verse of chapter, first verse of chapter 17, that he's ready for the grave. My breath is corrupt, or maybe my spirit is spent or broken. And then verse 2 to 5, he refers to the mockers, his friends, supposed friends. He's saying in verse 2, doth not mine eye continue in their provocation, or because of their provocation, my eye is awake. I might get some kind of rest if it wasn't for the provocation of these so-called friends. And then in verse 3, he's saying that since no one else will, he asks God to be his surety or his guarantor. That's the idea of striking hands. If someone acted as a guarantor for someone else, they would strike hands. And it's as if he's asking God to stand bail for him, to show his confidence in his basic integrity and innocence, because no one else will. And then he commits what his friends are saying to God. For thou hast hid, verse 4, for thou hast hid their heart from understanding, therefore shalt not thou not exalt them. He that speaketh flattery to his friends, even the eyes of his children shall fail. He's warning his friends. He's saying, your problem is that God has hidden understanding from you, and God will not exalt them. And of course that was true. And he's also referring to the idea of false testimony in court for personal advantage. And he's saying his friends are like that. They're like bribe witnesses accusing him unjustly. Verse 6, he's saying that everyone talks about Job. Everyone's saying, look at Job. He must have been such a wicked man, and now God has judged him. And they use the tabret and they make songs about Job. Everybody looked up to Job, but not now. And verse 7, his body is like a shadow with no substance. His members, the parts of his body. Verse 8 and 9, he's saying the godly will be astonished at him and stirred up against real hypocrites like his friends. Upright men shall be astonished at this, and the innocent shall stir up himself against the hypocrite. They will be stirred when they see Job's plight and they know he's a godly man. They'll be stirred up against men like these three friends, and they'll also be stirred up themselves to greater perseverance as they see Job persevering in affliction. Verse 9, the righteous also shall hold on his way, and he that hath clean hands shall be stronger and stronger. And in verse 10, he's saying, but as for you all, do ye return and come now, for I cannot find one wise man among you. He's saying, all right, have another go, if you've got something worth saying. But so far, you haven't. And then verse 11, to the end, he sinks into despondency, and he sees his plans and his hopes and his aspirations coming to nothing. Affliction means that night becomes like the day and day like the night. In verse 12, because of his affliction, the nights when he ought to rest, he's just as awake as he is during the day. And the day seems short because of darkness, because he feels so afflicted and ill that it's like the darkness of night. In other words, what he's saying is light and darkness, day and night, have ceased to have any great significance. He doesn't rest at night, and he doesn't feel the benefit of the day. He can't do anything. He just suffers, whether it's day or night. And then the last few verses, he's saying that he and his aspirations only have the grave in front of them. Well, now that's a summary of these three chapters. Well, some lessons. There are many lessons that we've learned already before, but I'll try to give some new elements tonight. First of all, we see that there is no meeting of minds where there is no agreement on salvation by grace. There is no meeting of minds where there is no agreement that salvation is by grace. Eliphaz believes in God. At no point does Eliphaz or any of the others question that there is a God. He professes to believe that God is sovereign. So at no point has he said that Job's afflictions come outside of the plan of God. It's God who ultimately has afflicted Job. He also believes in God's justice, that God punishes sin. But he doesn't seem to have any place for grace. I think we said on another occasion that Job's friends have a somewhat mechanical view of God. And so he tries to make out that the wicked are judged in this life, and they're judged quickly. He has no grasp then that God shows long suffering even to wicked men. The three friends, you see, assume all along that not only is Job's wretched condition a sign of his great wickedness, but their prosperous condition is a sign of their righteousness. And also, there's no place for salvation by grace in his concept of things. He has no concept of God sanctifying his people by grace. No place for affliction in the plan of God as a means whereby he sanctifies his true children. And so he doesn't alter his position at all. He completely misunderstands Job. If Job claims innocence, he confuses it with sinlessness. He doesn't understand Job. For Eliphaz, it's all black and white. For Eliphaz, you're either good or you're bad. And what Job is maintaining is, yes, he's a sinner, but he's a believer. He's not using those terms, but to put it in more familiar language, language that comes more to the fore as we go on in Scripture, what Job is saying is that he's a believer. And for Eliphaz, there are just good people like himself and bad people who get their just deserts like Job. Good and bad. Not sinners, some of whom are saved by grace and are believers, and some who are not saved. You see, salvation doesn't enter into it. Grace doesn't really enter into it at all. In other words, Eliphaz is something of a Pharisee. And have we not found the same? That the unbeliever frequently misunderstands us. The unbeliever can't understand our claim to be forgiven and accepted with God. He thinks that's pride. What, you are accepted with God and we're not? Even though our acceptance and our belief that we are accepted is based on what God himself has said about how he will accept sinners, it's construed as pride. And the unregenerate man misunderstands both the humility and the confidence of the believer. The humility he takes for weakness, the confidence he takes for arrogance. He sees both as a threat. And Job's misery didn't prevent Eliphaz defending his hurt pride. I think I've mentioned this perhaps before, but as you go through life, if you're a believer, don't you find it astonishing the situations in which people will defend their pride? Ghastly situations, wretched situations, situations where others are suffering and so on, and there they are defending their precious little corner of pride, because there's nothing more precious to an ungodly man than his pride. That's why Ahithophel killed himself, because his standing was lost and he couldn't live with it. And here's Eliphaz, Job covered in sores, in a dreadful state. Here's Eliphaz on his high horse. Can't stick it that Job shouldn't listen to him, that Job should try and tell him something. After all, as we realize, he's all right, Job's afflicted, he's good, Job's bad. And then there's the need for vigilance. The scripture tells us, 1 Peter 5:9, that we are to resist the devil. It talks about the roaring lion going about seeking whom he may devour, whom resists steadfast in the faith. Job's warmth is due partly to this. The more his faith is assailed, the bolder he becomes in maintaining the faith. Now, Satan and by means of these supposed friends, are seeking to drive him to despair. And he does indeed hover on the brink of despair. But we find that he becomes stronger and clearer in his profession of faith as we go on. However disjointed some of the things he says in his distress, he becomes clearer and stronger. For although the devil and his agencies seek to drive Job to despair, though they mean it for evil, God means it for good. And although in the first two chapters we've seen that God's plan in this affliction of Job was to demonstrate the genuineness of Job's faith in the Redeemer and his love, his unselfish love to God, yet also, since all things work together for good to them that love God and are called according to his purpose, not only does God demonstrate his faith and his love, but he strengthens that faith and love through all this affliction. And we can see that the clarity and the strength of Job's profession and his confidence of acceptance with God grows. It comes in waves, but it gets greater as the book goes on. All of God's dealings with us are designed to try to demonstrate the genuineness and to increase the faith of the people of God. So the Canaanite woman who came to Christ, you remember that she came because Christ at first ignored her. It's in Matthew 15, verse 23 and 28. Christ ignored her. The disciples discouraged her. And then Christ's initial words did not seem encouraging either. And yet, he was ordering all of these things in order to bring about a greater and greater expression of faith and confidence in Christ from this woman. And then thirdly, Job sifts what was said to him. Job sifts what was said to him. He acknowledges what is true, that he looks like a man being judged for his sin, but he denies what was false, the man-made conclusion that the reason was because he was a hypocrite. He sifts. He says, yes, I do look like that, but your assumption about the reason is wrong. Job still seeks to try the spirits, even in his dreadful affliction. And even what was said by his friends, so that even in trouble, and even when it's friends speaking to us, we must try the spirits, whether they be of God. We must sift what is said to us. And then finally, Job's confidence in a heavenly advocate. That confidence becomes more apparent as we go on. But it's here already. He knows that all he needs is an advocate in heaven. How much Job at that time in biblical revelation, how much he understood, we don't know. We can't say, and there's no point in trying to guess. But he saw that all he needed was an advocate on high. If he had that, then what his friends thought didn't matter very much at all. In other words, it's the equivalent of what we have in Romans 8. If God be for us, who can be against us? It is God that justifies. Who is he that condemneth? It is Christ that died, yea, rather that is risen again,